This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we examine what it means when you have a fever, plus the latest information on eating disorders. But first, it's all about sleep problems. Sleep disorders are at epidemic proportions worldwide and affect both the health and the quality of life for all who suffer from them. And what's worse is that they occur in both adults and children. The good news, though, is that they can be prevented and treated. And here with more on this are Dr. Dragos Manta, Assistant Professor of Medicine and the Co-Director of the Sleep Center at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Zafir Sultan, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, specializing in pediatric pulmonary medicine and the Director of the Pediatric Sleep Center at Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Manta, sleep disorders are ubiquitous. They're everywhere in this country, and seems like it's all over the world. Why do you think that is these days?
Well, I think there are at least a couple of issues that I can think of. One of them is definitely the increased awareness. Unfortunately, there was not too much science in sleep medicine until, I would say, the last 20, 30 years. And so the physicians are more aware, the patients are more aware. That's probably one of the reasons. The other reasons, unfortunately, is the obesity epidemic that our country and a lot of the world is dealing with right now.
That makes
prevalence of one of the main sleep conditions that we're treating, sleep apnea, be much higher than used to be in the past.
So, in fact, there really are clear reasons. The fact is, the obesity thing leading to sleep apnea, which is one of, as you said, the highest incidence of sleep disorders are caused by something like, in adults, are caused by sleep apnea.
Caused or at least make it more easy to show up, basically.
Yeah. And what do you think about the idea of so many more people, both adults and children, and we'll talk to you, Dr. Sultan, about the children, but are on, kind of on devices, everybody's kind of tuned, plugged in, wired up. Do you think that, in terms of being 24/7 available to either work 24/7 or be in touch with someone communicating 24/7, do you think that has an impact on why we're seeing so many erratic sleep?
Yeah, surely it does. And that's probably the other epidemic and contributing to this. And that's the fact that people are very sleep deprived these days. Unfortunately, as you said, everybody's on their computers, on their iPhones, and everybody goes to sleep later and later. And therefore, sleep deprivation is definitely contributing to the sleep problems that people have.
So apart from there being just something like an occasional night of insomnia, but when you're having a real constant problem like this, it's both environmental, but it can also be based on some other pathology, like you were talking about, the issue of obesity and their co-occurring issue of sleep disorder.
That's correct.
So, Dr. Sultan, how common are sleep disorders in kids?
Depends of what disorder we're talking about, and I'm not sure we know exactly. So in children, as Dr. Mehta mentioned, we have two major issues. We have the breathing problems, and we have the poor quality of sleep or inadequacy of sleep issue. And as far as the breathing problem, we think that 3% of kids do have breathing disorder. They do snore, and their snoring is associated with breathing problem, that they stop breathing, and they do have adverse consequences because of that.
Would you call that childhood sleep apnea?
Yes.
Then? So it is a form of sleep apnea.
Yes. And as far as the other part of sleep disorders, which is the talking about inadequacy of sleep, insomnia, restless sleep. This, actually, we are not sure exactly how common it is, but it depends of what you. It depends of is it gonna reach a disorder level or if it's just a developmental stage. So if it's developmental stage, I think it's very, very common. Disorder is not that common, I think, I think quite high percentage of children are not aware or adolescents are not aware of the hours of sleep they need to get in order for them to be to function normally next day. So if we take it this way, that it's just phenomena, I think it's very common.
So let me just get it clear. Yes. So there are, you say, a small percentage of kids who have real breathing problems, mm-hmm. such as sleep apnea, that could contribute to it. But what I'm also hearing is that in the main, some of it has to do with poor sleeping habits, mm-hmm. and maybe even a cultural pressure, especially when you get to the adolescent level, of like sleep is for wimps or mm-hmm. something. You know, yes. I can get by with 2 hours of sleep mm-hmm. and I can be up on all night long on my, you know, on the computer and then get up and go to school the next mm-hmm. day.
Yes.
So there are some real physiologic disorders that exist in childhood, but you see a lot of these other things playing a role.
Absolutely. As you said, cultural issues or habits, which start from infancy. There are families who prefer that their kids sleep with them, with the same room, which is a bad habit because eventually the kid will not learn how to sleep on his own or her own. And again, cultural thing is that the adolescents, the high school children, they believe that or they think that sleep is not necessary and they can get by sleeping a couple of hours only. And that also kind of, this is the thing, this is a habit. So, and that can lead eventually to disorder.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's Health Link on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and I'm here with Drs. Manta and Sultan. They're experts on sleep medicine, and we're talking about sleep problems in both adults and children. So, Dr. Manta, there's a wide range of disorders that exist with adults, right? I mean, you can have sleepwalking. I mean, there's all kinds of things we've talked about. Mm-hmm. But regardless, and the same is true, I guess, well, there aren't as wide a range for children, but regardless of the cause, the underlying cause of lack of sleep, this lack of sleep has to contribute to a wide range of problems. What are the kinds of behavioral things that you see in adults who have sleep problems, sleep disorders?
All right. Well, one of the most common sleep disorder, like we talked about, is sleep apnea, and that is very well associated with excessive daytime sleepiness. So a lot of the patients that have this condition, not necessarily all of them, but most of them have problems staying awake and alert during the day. Unfortunately, that can lead to a lot of problems, from as minor as, you know, poor concentration to something that would impair them to do their work responsibilities.
So they have poor job performance.
Poor job performance. I did have patients that unfortunately they lost their job because they couldn't stay awake.
Really?
Yeah. And ultimately, you know, and that's probably the one thing that I worry the most is car accidents. Unfortunately, you know, if you fall asleep while driving, that doesn't forgive you. Sometimes, and you can hurt yourself or hurt somebody else, and that's something very serious that we all need to be very aware of.
Absolutely. How about emotional things like depression or increase in depression or anxiety? I would think sleep deprivation really contributes greatly to your emotional well-being.
Definitely, sleep problems, you know, are definitely very interconnected with psychiatrical problems, psychological problems, including anxiety.
And you've seen that a lot in your patients.
Oh, yeah.
And how about you, Dr. Sultan, with children? What are the ramifications, you know, of having difficulty sleeping for whatever the underlying cause?
Yes. So if the children don't get the required sleep hours of sleep, the next day they will be sleepy, tired, they have poor cognitive function, poor school performance, inability to concentrate on tasks, and they don't get the grades which is expected from them, and sometimes they are hyperactive. Actually, sometimes younger kids in particular, they manifest the sleepiness by being hyperactive. And there's quite a few kids who are mislabeled as being having attention deficit and hyperactivity just because simply they're not getting enough sleep at night. This is the daytime. These are the daytime manifestations. Nighttime manifestations, usually it's inability to sleep, insomnia, frequent awakenings. That's what happened actually during the night, that they sometimes, if they do have breathing disorders, the parents would observe them having difficulty breathing. They do manifest by apnea, which means they just stop breathing.
Do you see emotional disturbances also in children who have sleep problems?
Moodiness,
if only that.
Associations have been found with actually even snoring. Snoring without stop breathing, with daytime having irritability and
irritability. So it seems to me that something obviously can be done, and there's a process of trying to figure out what needs to be done for both adults and children. And I understand one thing that's become very, very important is a sleep study to understand the nature of what people are doing, whether they're adults or children, what their sleep looks like. And so I know you have a sleep lab. We just mm-hmm. talked about that. And I understand that you're opening a new one. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Let me get to that in a bit. I just wanted to actually bring up one more important point that I think we need to do before we go to the next step. And that would be that I think we, both of us, talked about short-term consequences of sleep problems. But I think one of the main things that I'm worried in my patients that, you know, tend to be, you know, a little bit older than Dr. Sultan's patients is long-term cardiovascular risk. And unfortunately, that's one of the main thing that that we try to prevent by treating sleep conditions, especially sleep apnea, because there is increased cardiovascular risk, including heart attacks, strokes, even dementia. So because of that, it's very important to be aware of this condition and try to figure out what the risk is for an individual patient and go to the next step, which in many cases involves coming and spending a night in the sleep lab to figure out if they do have sleep apnea or they don't, or if they have any other condition that we need to treat.
That's a very key point. Thank you for mentioning that. So you are moving the sleep laboratory to a new location. Tell us about where you're going and what will it look like and who will you be helping?
Yeah, we are excited to have a new sleep lab. It's state-of-the-art facility. In pediatric in particular, we're going to have 4 dedicated beds for children, and which is exactly actually what we wanted for our area. So we are pleased to announce that the lab is going to be brand new, is going to be opening soon, and it's fully equipped. And just to touch on the process starts by educating the public about the importance of sleep and make family aware of the symptoms of sleep disorder, and then seek attention of the pediatrician, who the pediatrician usually they're aware, and they make the referral to our center, where we evaluate the patient and determine what is the next step. Mentioning the sleep lab, sometimes in some sleep disorders, sleep lab is necessary. A sleep study, which means the child or the patient will spend the night in the lab to observe his or her sleep pattern, brain waves, breathing pattern, to make the diagnosis of the disorder. So that is the role of the sleep lab.
And with the adults, very, very briefly, I don't want to run out of time, it's a similar thing.
Yeah, I would say one of the most important things is to be seen by a physician, preferably by a sleep-certified physician, before undergoing a sleep study, to make sure that the right sleep study is ordered and the sleep study is indicated.
And then treatment protocols are determined. And
based on that, yes.
Right. And you're going, if you want information about the new upstate sleep lab, you can call 315-464-8668. That's Upstate Connects. And we'll have information, more contact information, on our website, HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. Well, I want to thank you both for coming in. Very, very, very important
thank you for having
information.
Us. Thank you.
My guests have been Dr. Dragos Manta, Assistant Professor of Medicine and the Co-Director of the Sleep Center at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Safir Sultan, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, and he's also the Director of the Pediatric Sleep Center at Upstate Golisano Children's Hospital. Thanks so much for
coming.
Thank you. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, what does it mean when you have a fever? This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here. For this week's What's Your Emergency segment, Dr. Derek Cooney sat down with Dr. Christian Knudsen to talk about fever.
Today I'm speaking with Dr. Christian Knudsen, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine and the Medical Director for EMS Education Programs at SUNY Upstate Medical University. We're talking about fever. Now, fever is defined as a body temperature of greater than 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit and is typically the sign of infection or other illness. When a fever occurs, it usually means the body's fighting an infection, a minor viral infection, a major life-threatening bacterial bloodstream infection, or anything in between. Dr. Knudsen, thank you for being with us today. Enlighten us. What does it mean when somebody has a fever? What's going on inside their body that makes that temperature rise?
Well, whenever somebody has a fever, their body's fighting some sort of infection. And you're right, it can be very minor or very severe. The fever is just the body's response to trying to fight that infection. So the body recognizes whatever the infection is, and your body and your blood respond by releasing chemicals that increase the temperature of your body, trying to slow down that infection.
So it's a response to the infection. It's not really the infection causing. It's actually your immune system then.
Correct. The bacteria or viruses themselves can't cause a fever, but your body's response is what's causing the fever.
Okay. So it's indicating that you're fighting. All right. What about fluctuations in temperature? We hear that a lot. So you know, we hear a mother say, "Well, I put Susie down for bed. She had a stuffy nose, but there was no fever, so I didn't worry about it. But now it's 3 a.m. in the morning, and I'm very concerned because now there's a high fever." That seems to be a pattern. Can you comment on that?
There is some normal fluctuation to your body temperature as the day goes on. At night is kind of the point where your body temperature is the highest. So if you do have the start of an infection, runny nose, sore throat, or a common cold, for your child, it may be overnight the fever becomes highest, both at the point where your temperature is highest and when the infection started for your child as well.
All right. So it sounds like it can change throughout the day, and it's a natural response to infection. But so then if that's the case, and, you know, it's supposed to happen, why do we treat fever? Is it dangerous, or are we trying to improve the patient's comfort, or are there reasons that apply to both, or what's going on there? Why do we treat that?
Typically, fever by itself is not dangerous, but it does make you feel miserable. Your body hurts, you feel hot, sweaty, and again, you're just miserable. So we can treat that fairly easily with either acetaminophen or ibuprofen. It makes you feel so much better. But also you want to heal from whatever the infection is, and treating the fever does help you get better. You want to drink plenty of fluids and rest, and treating the fever will help you drink, keep your strength up, and fight the infection.
And that same treatment does seem to bring down the muscle aches and the overall feeling of ill.
Yeah, it just makes you feel better. I mean, when you're sick, you feel miserable with a fever, and treating it just gets you through the illness that much better.
All right, so obviously we're going to be focusing a lot on infection and kind of how to identify it and treat it, but there's also some other causes of fever. What kind of other things cause fever that might be indistinguishable or might have to be ruled out or thought of when somebody has a fever?
Again, infection is, you're right, most common cause of fever. There are some other less usual things. Obviously, during the summertime, if you're outside in the heat, you can have heat stroke or heat illness where your temperature's up. It's not really a fever where your body's causing a inflammatory reaction, but it's just a response to the environment. So heat illness could be a cause of a high temperature. Some medications can cause your temperature to go up, especially illicit drugs. Cocaine, PCP, crystal meth, stimulants, all those can make your temperature go up. So if someone's acting goofy or altered and have a fever, as ER doctors, we always think about drug ingestions as a possibility.
And in those drugs, you also mean like regular medications, not necessarily recreational drugs, but some other regular medications, either as a side effect or in an overdose situation.
Right. Even over-the-counter Benadryl, if people overdose on that can cause a fever. Or just your regular prescribed medicines, if you have a bad reaction to them, rare, but they can cause a fever as well.
But those situations wouldn't be necessarily an infection, but that someone probably needs to seek medical attention too, or?
I would think so. If you're having a bad enough reaction to a medicine where it's causing a fever, you should be seen either by your doctor that same day or come to the emergency department to make sure the reaction isn't getting worse or being life-threatening in those cases.
We commonly worry about a fever for the other reasons you talked about, but it is a common concern that the fever is very, very high. And I know you just said that it's usually on its own, it's not terribly dangerous, but does it cause seizure?
Typically, a fever does not. Patients will come to us and worry about brain damage or seizures or long-term effects from a fever, and that's very rare if ever happens. For general infections, the infection can cause problems, but the fever itself is not dangerous. If you get over 106, 107, it's usually something else, either a reaction to medications, overdose, heat stroke. That can be more dangerous as you get really high. But again, that's unusual to have with an infection by itself.
So it's maybe not a specific temperature that we're concerned about, but if it does get as high as 106, 107, 108, that's concerning, if not for any other reason than there's something else going on.
I'd say, yeah, they should come to the hospital.
All right. What about just your typical adult with a fever? When should they be seen? Because fevers are common, but how do we know in an adult or maybe even an adult of advanced age or an elderly person, when do they need to see the doctor for their fever?
I think kind of the reverse is true. When do you not have to see a doctor? If you're able to control the fever with Tylenol or ibuprofen, you're drinking fluids, your strength is staying up, you don't have to be eating solids, but mostly drinking fluids. And if you're getting through, you don't have to go to the hospital right away. But if you're not doing well, you have the fever, you have some other symptoms of other infections, bad sore throat, you can't drink fluids, you're coughing up phlegm, you're very short of breath, or something else is wrong, then those are reasons you should come to the hospital and get checked out.
What about days of fever? Does that matter?
Not usually. I mean, a common cold is by far the most common cause of fever that we see. And that can last between up to 5 to 7 days. So even though you have a fever for several days, it's not dangerous or not a reason to come to the hospital. You should be seen by a doctor to see if there's anything we can treat, a bacterial infection. But it's not surprising to us that people have a fever for 5, 7, 10 days.
Oh, okay. So tell us, go through this for us, break it down for us. What are the sort of things we would expect to be causing a fever? What are the common infectious problems that adults and maybe even the elderly patients?
The most common we see is the common cold, runny nose, postnasal drip, sore throat, body aches, and just not feeling well. We see that quite often. If you have ear pain, problems hearing, pain in your ear, you have to think about ear infections. A bad sore throat is most often a viral infection. Some people can have strep pharyngitis. They have pus in the back of their throat, large lymph nodes, fever, and no other cold symptoms. That could be strep throat. Pneumonia, chest pain, fevers and chills, bad cough, shortness of breath. That's very common as well. Probably more common is bronchitis, where you have shortness of breath, a bad cough that doesn't get better, maybe some wheezing. Your doctor can tell either by listening to your lungs or getting an x-ray of your chest if it's a bronchitis or pneumonia. Obviously, if you're pneumonia, you need antibiotics. For bronchitis, you don't. Urinary tract infections are common, pain when you urinate, blood in your urine, having to go more often, or back pain is a serious sign of a kidney infection with that, which are fairly common as well.
And the elderly population may have those symptoms as well, even before the fever. So paying attention to the associated symptoms is important.
In the elderly, if you have a fever, that can be more serious than younger adults. If someone's elderly has a fever, it could be a sign of a very serious infection. We do take elderly people with fever more seriously because of the risk of having more advanced infection or becoming sicker if they have other health problems as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate HealthLink on Air. I'm Dr. Derek Cooney, and I'm speaking with Dr. Christian Knudsen of Emergency Medicine about fever. Now, you also work in the Adult Emergency Department at SUNY Upstate University Hospital, but you also work at the Golisano Children's Hospital Emergency Department. What about children? Do we treat those children differently? Is there different causes of fever? Is something specific about them? And what about the very young children?
I think in children roughly 4 months and older, we treat them much like adults. We look for what's causing the fever for them. Again, colds, ear infections, throat infections, pneumonia, bronchitis, especially in the winter months, and croup as well. We see that quite often, and when most children come to the hospital, that's what we find. In the very young, we do take them very seriously. Children less than 8 weeks or 9 weeks, they can't fight infections very well. Their bodies just don't have the immune system, so if they have a fever, it could be the sign of a virus or a sign of a serious, you know, either meningitis or pneumonia or a very serious infection. And for them, they get a very thorough workup. They get x-rays of the chest, they get blood work. They may get a spinal tap looking for meningitis as well. They might stay in the hospital until we figure out the cause of their fever. So the very young, we take very seriously. Over 4 months, we take seriously as well, but usually we find other causes for their fever.
So it sounds like what we're talking about is when we have a fever, we really need to know what the associated symptoms are. It matters how old you are. If you're a senior citizen versus an average adult versus a child versus a young child, sometimes fever is a minor condition that just needs the physician to look at you. But sometimes fever means to the physician that, oh my goodness, looks like we're going to get a big workup here. And you mentioned a couple of things, blood tests, urine tests. What are the things that may need to be done? And do you need to stay in the hospital for fever?
I think really what most people need is a very good physical exam, a skilled doctor who knows how to look at you and examine you thoroughly can often find the source of infection just by a good exam. But if you are sicker, very young, very old, or have other health problems, you can expect to get blood tests, look at your white count, see how high it is, make sure your kidneys are working okay, get an x-ray of your chest looking for pneumonia or other infectious problems, urine tests looking for urinary tract infections. If you have belly pain, we work that up with ultrasounds or CT scans. And it also depends how sick you are. If you have a minor fever, a good exam. If you're sicker, you'll get more tests.
Well, Dr. Knutson, that was an excellent overview of fever and how we should be responding to it. And I'd like to thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. See how high it is. Make sure your kidneys are working okay. Get an x-ray of your chest looking for pneumonia or other infectious problems. Urine tests looking for urinary tract infections. If you have belly pain, we work that up with ultrasounds or CT scans. And it also depends how sick you are. If you have a minor fever, a good exam. If you're sicker, you'll get more tests.
Well, Dr. Knutson, that was an excellent overview of fever and how we should be responding to it. And I'd like to thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. Survival of the fittest and or survival of the happiest? Well, folks, can you stand 30 seconds of theory lecture before we get to some knowing changes everything really information? And I'm 90% sure that even if you're knowing it, you're not doing it to live longer, healthier, and happier. Really? Well, ready or not, here it comes. Evolutionary psychology says the ways our brain functions were selected by the forces of nature because those ways enhanced our ability to survive. And those things that enhanced our ability to survive were linked to the brain's pleasure center saying, do more of that, do more of that. So we do more of it and be more likely to survive and pass the genetic code that keeps track of how our brains and bodies work on to the next generation. Pleasure in the short run, life satisfaction and happiness point into survival in the long run. Now, we humans developed into social beings, living in groups, and peoples whose brains help them work well in groups had a survival advantage because together, two or three or four or five of us were more likely to fend off one Attila the Hun or Attila with a bunch of Huns from taking what we needed to survive, our food, shelter, tools, potential mates. Okay, theory over, practical application time. Over the past few weeks, I've noticed I've been less happy than usual, and I've been checking out why. Any major disruption in my close relationships, my social circle? Nope. Actually, the opposite. I've been feeling closer to my friends and family, largely because I'd noticed I was out of balance, too much work, not enough play. I got dull and dispirited, so I started to call and chat and make dinner and movie dates to make a friend be a friend. So, happier there. So what was causing this dip to down in the dumps? Well, then I realized I've had a sore foot and haven't been doing my daily run or even biking to work, my daily commute that I love. And study after study shows that regularly moving the bod briskly makes the brain little Mr. or little Ms. happy. Less anxious, less tense, less depressed, instead perkier and more energetic. So no surprise, I lost some of my zip. Now another shocking fact. Only about 10% of us alleged adults get any regular brisk movement. I hesitate to say exercise because then we think pain, not the pleasure of brisk bodily bodaciousness. And of course, the research also shows over and over and over that bopping the bod bodaciously, for example, just brisk walking for 10 minutes or more a day, keeps us living longer and healthier and happier. So, now, if you're trying to decide, should I put this knowing changes everything into action, remember, there was no lazy boy recliner or widescreen TV in the man cave or woman cave back in Cro-Magnon days. But it was fun to run, to grab dinner, or snag a partner to work on passing along our genes. Hope to see you out there chasing a happier, healthier life. I'm Rich, your Paleolithic pal, O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, eating disorders, what we know and can do about them. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for October 28th. One man's trash is another man's measure. Keep track of how much you're eating by living with your food packaging and remains. One study offering all-you-can-eat chicken wings found that participants whose leftover bones had been cleared away ate 34% more than diners whose remnants remained at the table. That's a lot of wings. Visual reminders like candy wrappers, soda cans, and takeout receipts can help you keep track of how much you've already consumed so you'll be less likely to overeat. This week, take the no-throw challenge and keep your wrappers, empty containers, bones, and other bits on the table during the entire meal. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. More people are being diagnosed with eating disorders every year, and the problem is showing up earlier as well. And eating disorders have the highest death rates of all mental disorders. Well, here with more on this troubling problem is Kathleen Dieters-Hayes, assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and a licensed clinical social worker specializing in women's eating disorders at Upstate Medical University. Thanks for coming in, Kathleen.
You're welcome.
So eating disorders are showing up earlier, and it's not just limited to girls and women. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, I think there's a lot more awareness in the world about eating disorders, and there are more treatment options, so people are coming forward a little bit more. But there have always been eating disorders since around the 1900s, the first eating disorder was diagnosed. But men's eating disorders, you're right, have become a lot more mainstream. There's a lot more of that information out there. And I think more men are coming for treatment, saying they're not, you know, so worried about saying that they have an eating disorder. So
it may just more appear that there are more of them.
Yes.
Rather than they're in fact.
I think that's true. I think that's true, yes.
So tell us, let's be really more specific about what is an eating disorder.
Okay.
Help us understand that.
Okay. Well, specifically, there are three types of eating disorders that we use with people have heard about the DSM. The new DSM-5 is coming out. And there are three categories. The first one is anorexia nervosa. And this eating disorder is mainly diagnosed when someone is below 85% of their normal body weight. That can be a child, that can also be an adult or an adolescent or a male. And for in women, especially who are adolescents and adults, they've lost their menstrual cycle. And they have a distorted image of their bodies. Bulimia nervosa is the second kind. And this usually is seen in individuals, both men and women, who are at a normal body weight, but they do things like they purge or they binge on food and then they throw it up. They could also purge without throwing up by overexercising, using laxatives or diuretics. So there's different ways that people purge food. The third category is called binge eating disorder. This is a new diagnostic category, although it's been around forever. We just used the category in the past of eating disorder NOS, which means not otherwise specified. Mm-hmm. And binge eating disorder is really, lots of people use words like emotional eating, compulsive overeating, people overeat. They use food to soothe themselves, to manage uncomfortable emotions, and not everybody, but most people are overweight who have binge eating disorder.
Sounds to me like there's some kind of overlap between the bulimia nervosa, mm-hmm. where there's binge eating but purging following
yes.
it, and the binge eating disorder where people may do the same, but they don't purge.
That's right. They don't purge.
So those are kind of the three kind mm-hmm. of diagnostic categories.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds to me like there may be elements, or what have you found? Are there elements that people share?
Absolutely. 50% of people who present with any kind of an eating disorder don't fit neatly into one of those categories. So they end up with a diagnosis of eating disorder NOS. And people sometimes will swing between being underweight, using binging and purging at the same time, gaining weight, moving into bulimia nervosa. Now we have people who have bariatric surgery who also sometimes will lose a lot of weight and end up with an eating disorder
following their surgery.
So they'll either have bulimia, trying to manage keeping the weight off, or they will have lost so much weight and become very obsessive and end up with anorexia.
So you mentioned obsessive. So mm-hmm. at the core of all of these mm-hmm. What is hypothesized as mm-hmm. the root cause of developing? I mean, is there a genetic propensity, for example, or is there just an environmental one?
I think it's unclear right now. There is a lot of research out there, especially on anorexia, that there's a genetic component to this. But there are
that
also
it runs in families, really?
There is some research being done that hasn't been proven. Anorexia is a really mysterious illness, and the research also shows that any kind of therapy, whether it's CBT, psychodynamic, interpersonal, there really isn't a type of therapy that works better than others with anorexia. It's mostly the relationship with the therapist.
So the anorexia of all these mm-hmm. of all these types mm-hmm. is the one that's hardest to address.
I think it is, yes. And
is it also the one that's most threatening to life? Because it strikes me that some percentage of those people do mm-hmm. go on to
yes,
die.
Yes, they do. Yes. Bulimia can also be very life-threatening. If someone is throwing up, they can have seizures, they can have a heart attack, they can go into a coma. So I don't want to at all minimize that. You can also get an esophageal tear from throwing up, which can also be life-threatening. So those two eating disorders are both very dangerous.
Yeah, and it would seem to me that binge eating and obesity that potentially could follow
in the long term, absolutely.
In the long term,
yes.
Leads to countless other problems. We'll get back to that in a minute. But
sure.
So as far as causation, you think things like genetics may play a role, but what else do you think is playing a role here?
It's very complicated. I do think there are environmental issues. Sometimes people have a trauma history of some kind. So, for example, they may have been sexually abused or physically abused, and they're using food to try to manage
Is it a way of trying to gain control of an otherwise uncontrollable environment?
It can be, absolutely. And we hear that a lot, that people have control issues. I think that's true, but usually underneath that is a lot of anxiety. Also, 50% of people with eating disorders have pretty serious depression. So
there's a multitude
absolutely.
Of factors. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and I'm here with Upstate social worker Kathleen Dieters-Hayes, and we're talking about a very troubling subject, and that's eating disorders. So there are a lot of complex psychological factors that could be playing a role, but it's been said many times, especially in the last, I'd say, 15, 20 years, for young girls or girls, there's so much pressure to be thin.
Yes.
The media messages are so strong,
yes.
and for them to grow up earlier. Do you see that as playing a significant role in shaping some of these issues?
Yes, I do. I think it's not the reason people, I don't want to get too reductionistic and say that's why people develop it, but I don't think it helps. And as you know, young girls are very much into, you know, buying clothes. This is very normal in adolescence. They want to look nice. They want to look like their peers. And if they're not feeling like they fit in, one thing that they can do to sort of shape themselves up is to try to go on a diet and make themselves look better. And sometimes that's okay, but for a lot of people who already have an anxiety disorder prior to dieting, that can really exacerbate their anxiety, and they can kind of then sort of feel like they're out of control with being able to interrupt that.
It strikes me as a slippery slope.
It is.
Because we're always talking about fitness.
Mm-hmm.
We have
Absolutely.
This major obesity crisis
yeah.
in children as well as adults who then go on to type 2 diabetes and the
yep.
whole, you know, a metabolic syndrome
yes.
that can follow.
Yes.
And we want people to be fit and to be appropriate weight. So with all of that pressure,
right.
which you think, just what you said, if there's an underlying problem there, they could just fall off the edge, so
right.
to speak.
That's right.
Yeah. So tell me very briefly, what are some of the symptoms? I don't want to run out of time. I want to get to treatment.
Sure.
But what do you see as some of the symptoms in any of these three?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will notice that people just are eating. They'll sit down with a family, but they'll just push their food around on their plate and they won't eat anything. Sometimes they'll eat maybe even more than they normally do, and they'll get up from the table immediately to go to the bathroom, and that could be somebody throwing up after their meal. Sometimes people, this is a little bit gross, but sometimes people will throw up in their bedrooms and parents will find that in the wastebasket. So any kind of change in their sort of normal behavior, I think, is a red flag to take a look at. If they decide they want to go on a diet, I think actually that's a red flag that they need to talk, the family needs to talk with them about that.
Or at least how to approach
Absolutely.
A diet, maybe from a very healthful standpoint.
Absolutely.
With reasonable expectations.
Yes, because most adolescents don't know how to diet. They don't know how to do that.
And as you mentioned, there are so many long-term health considerations, even short of dying,
yes.
that you can run into.
Yes.
What are some of those?
Well, you can have all kinds of heart problems. That's one of the biggest that I try to stay on top of, because when you're throwing up, your electrolytes are off, and it can cause some major heart problems. You can also, with anorexia, even in a fairly short amount of time, develop osteopenia, which is reversible, but osteoporosis is not. So you want to try to interrupt that. And the reason people develop that is because their estrogen levels are so low.
And they don't menstruate, which
That's
has all
right.
kinds of other sequelae.
That's
and
right.
when they're so underweight, I would think you'd have all kinds of other damage
you can,
to multi-organs.
Absolutely. You can have, you know, your hair can fall out. People who are severe anorexics develop a layer of extra hair to keep their body warm, which is all white hair all over their body, which is very strange. And you can get malnourished very easily.
So there sound like a lot of sequelae there. Tell us how treatment works. What are the treatment options? What have you seen? What works?
Well, what I think has to happen, and it's a non-negotiable in the work that I do, is that every patient I see has to be followed by a primary care physician. If I will not see them if they're not, because I'm interested in looking at the underlying issues, and I feel like I have to know that they are being managed medically. So that's the first step. I usually tell patients that's what you have to do the first time after you see me.
In that case, hoping that the family physician or the internist or whomever is watching out for some of the warning signs or the problem issues health-wise.
Yes, and I'll have them have some lab work done and an EKG to start with. So the other thing that I do then is I see people individually. People over 18 do pretty well individually, but I'm also always assessing for whether they need to be inpatient or not. And severe anorexics almost always have to be hospitalized before they can do outpatient work. Bulimics typically can be managed on an outpatient basis, and so can binge eaters.
So individual therapy you found helped. Do certain types of therapy, something like CBT, the cognitive behavioral therapy, be more successful perhaps than, you know, psychoanalytic treatment?
Interestingly enough, only 50% of patients respond to CBT who have eating disorders, which is great, but that leaves another 50% of other people who don't. And I think sometimes psychodynamic works for people that want to understand what's going on underneath and also interpersonal, because this does, I didn't get into this too much, but this does have a big impact on people's relationships with each other. So,
well, I'm sure if there's hiding or lying or any of the things that go on around trying to...
They're isolating to try to manage this.
Right.
Absolutely.
How about medication?
There one medication that does have some efficacy is Prozac. It does help with reducing the urge to binge and purge. I do think medication helps with anxiety, too, so that can also lower people's need to starve themselves or also to overeat.
So ultimately, there has to be a comprehensive approach.
There does.
Whether it be inpatient at the outset or outpatient, it has to be comprehensive.
Yes.
And they are treatable. In the very little bit of time we have left, you think people basically can recover?
Absolutely. The reason people die from eating disorders is they don't get treatment. That's the main problem. And when people are in treatment, I think there's a really high recovery rate, like between 80 and 90%. So,
well, that's the good news.
Absolutely.
I appreciate your coming in and sharing all that very important information with me. My guest has been Kathleen Dieters-Hayes. She's assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences and a licensed clinical social worker specializing in women's eating disorders at Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, with today's selection. I'm interested in how parents exhibit and experience the illnesses of their children and how the healthcare system either helps them or hinders them in understanding what's happening with the children. I have a poem here about loss, the worst loss a parent can fear, losing a child, obviously. K.B. Kintzer is a wonderful poet from Georgia who lost her son. In this poem, she is both bitter and hopeful, and I think it's a very powerful poem. It's called The Good News. The ICU nurse who asked you, your young body gasping, did you really want a ventilator? You might not come off. She will die. Almost died that moment, a crushed windpipe. In dreams, she dies every night, my voice echoing her words until she loses consciousness. And the doctor, who said you'd reach the last stage of your disease 7 years before you did, that fat guy will die too, probably soon. The nurse who said, be a man, your body doubled in pain outside the hospital at 2 a.m. before two transfusions and round-the-clock morphine shots, she will die. They will all die. And the doctor who saw your pain and doubled your morphine, he too will die. And nurses who cradled you with pillows, with care, they will die. Transplant doctors who gave you 3 years, hoping for more, will die. And I, who saw everything, helpless to help, to hurt, I will die too. And when I shed this burning, this insufferable heat, this hate, when I molt this mortal sheath and slip into after, wherever you are, we can surround you again, all of us from before. I know nothing, but I hope. Time is the round Zion of the water bead. I know nothing, but I hope. Our time apart is shorter than a dream's width. I know nothing, but I hope.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLink On Air, all one word, .org. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Cirio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.